talk about testing inflation with combined power and wide spectrum. Although, you know, I arrived here and I've been jet lagged and waking up till, you know, since 4:30 a.m. And I decided to rewrite my talk. So I'm going to talk at the end about quite a bit of technical detail about how we do data analysis when we use large-scale structured data in order to measure things like non-Gaussianity from large-scale structure. So since we've had a lot of complex details, technical details about details of maths and theories from a lot of theorists yesterday, I'm going to do the data version of that because I think it's really important to understand all the details of what goes into this. But I'll start with a summary from Planck, just to set the context. Planck is, of course, the work of a lot of hard work of a lot of people. And so what's going on with inflationary models in a post-Planck world? So first of all, as Martin has summarized very well, this is the money plot from the inflation paper. And we see that from a single experiment for the first time, that exact scale invariance is ruled out at greater than phi sigma. And even though convex potentials are still allowed, these flattened potentials seem to be preferred by the Planck data. Of course, this has to be verified with future constraints that especially get better constraints on the tensor to scalar ratio. So Planck does not exclude, nor does it suggest, that there are many active fields during inflation. However, I think we have to say, if inflation is the theory behind the origin of structure in the universe, single field models are arguably the simplest that are allowed by the data. And so that's from the power spectrum. In terms of the bispectrum, so Kendrick gave a very nice overview of these results from Planck on Monday. So the bispectrum is now a commodity, it's a routine observable. And also theoretically, you know, it's no longer very impressive if you say, oh, I've got a theory for inflation, I can calculate the spectral index. Now the bispectrum is in the same mode. We have very good constraints on these standard bispectrum configurations from Planck. I've summarized them here, and they're not detected by Planck. So we have stringent constraints on these mostly scale-invariant bispectrum configurations, and we have less tight constraints on configurations where the scale invariance is very strongly broken, for example, very oscillatory models or spectra like that, which is relevant to something that I'm going to say later. And this hasn't been mentioned so far, but this is a really cool thing, so I thought I would summarize it. So Planck has detected a non-primordial non-Gaussianity, and it is a signal that's predicted by lambda CDM. So nonlinear effect cause coupling between the weak gravitational lensing of the CMB, shown in this very nice map that was produced by the Planck release, and the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect from evolving gravitational potentials in the late time universe. So these two effects have really no reason to talk to each other, but in a lambda CDM model, they're expected to be coupled and result in a bispectrum configuration. And this effect is a very non-trivial test of the standard lambda CDM model, and it has been seen in Planck for the first time at about 2.5 sigma. So we have very nice measurements of the power spectrum, and we have nice measurements of the bispectrum as well. But there's no detection of non-Gaussianity. So in past years, there was a lot of really nice effort from the theoretical community on constructing, for example, effective field theory settings for studying inflation. And maybe this is a provocative thing to say, but I think, you know, because we don't have this detection, it actually stalls progress via a kind of bottom-up reconstruction of the effective action for inflation. However, we still have this top-down approach available. So try to come up with first principles or a fundamental description of inflation rather than a phenomenological one, starting from a well-motivated theory, doing model building, and seeing if you can find non-generic observables for ruling out such models. So non-generic correlations between two-point and three-point observables provide very tight constraints on such models. So we can see some hints of this kind of program already from the Planck papers. So here are some joint constraints from two-point and three-point. So if you consider a general class of inflation models where the Lagrangian is a general function of the scalar field and its first derivative, the inflationary sound speed in these cases can be less than 1, whereas canonically it is 1. So we then have this parameter set where you have an overall amplitude for the primordial perturbations and the first two Schlorow parameters here and a sound speed. So if you assume constant sound speed, this parameter set would be completely degenerate without non-Gaussianity information. So here we have the first two Schlorow parameters, and in the canonical case, the CS is 1. So if you assume CS is 1, you get very tight constraints on that parameter set. And if you assume that CS can be less than 1 and you try to constrain it, then without the bispectrum information, you would have a perfect degeneracy. By just adding the bispectrum constraint on CS, which is that it's greater than 0.02, you can truncate that degeneracy. So this thing is starting to become powerful. And it can actually make very strong constraints on specific models of inflation, which makes predictions both for the power spectrum and a bispectrum. Here are a couple of examples from the Planck non-Gaussianity paper. So this is a model called infrared DBI. So Kendrick talked about DBI on Monday. This is a case where the DBI model, where the inflaton moves actually from the infrared to the UV side in this warped throat, and it has a potential which has this parameter beta. So theoretically, this parameter beta is allowed to vary over 9 orders of magnitude, so very, very large range in parameter space. And if you constrain this model using both the information from the spectral tilt and the DBI bispectrum shape, we limit beta to be less than 0.7, so essentially cutting out 9 orders of magnitude of parameter space. Another example is K-inflation, where this is a class of models where a single parameter makes a prediction both for the spectral index and equilateral FNL. And if you look at the two-point information, it limits this parameter gamma to be between 0.01 and 0.02. And if you look at the bispectrum, you get gamma is greater than 0.05. So these two constraints are inconsistent, so the model cannot simultaneously predict the Planck spectrum and the bispectrum. So it's basically inconsistent.
Can you remind us what gamma is?
I think it's related to the sound speed. Yeah. I don't want to focus on that model. This is just an example to motivate the talk. So here's an outline of what I'm actually going to talk about. So in this program where you can try to do inflation in a fundamental setting using a top-down approach, I'm going to show you a case study of monodromy inflation, which is one of the poster children for trying to embed inflation within string theory. That has multiple non-generic observables. It's a very predictive model, which is what we observers like. And so I'm going to show you an exercise where fit to the power spectrum gives interesting results and predictions for the bispectrum, which we can then go and look in the data. The second thing I'm going to talk about is, again, a case study of how one goes into trying to extract the large-scale angular power spectrum from large-scale structure surveys, including all sorts of systematic effects which you might not have heard of. I think a lot of theorists are actually quite familiar with CNB data analysis. But large-scale structure is maybe something more of a mystery, so I'm going to try to give you a flavor of just what goes into these kinds of analysis. So the first part of the talk is with two of my favorite collaborators, Richard Easter and Raphael Fager, and it's actually given in this paper. So axial monodromy is basically a class of models where you get a flattened potential. So technical naturalness, as most of you know, is where a theory is considered untuned if it has small numbers, but these small numbers are somehow generated dynamically, and if quantum corrections are suppressed by a symmetry principle. So flattened potentials are included in this Wilsonian natural class of inflationary models, and an approximate shift symmetry that's involved here can arise from pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone bosons, for example, axions. So the theoretical setting of monodromy inflation was proposed by Silverstein and Westphal and studied in these papers in great detail. The features of this model is that it is a large field model in the setting of string theory, where there's another scale which is wrapped around a compact direction. So you can go round and round this compact direction and gain field range. So it can achieve a a large field range means detectable tensor modes. And it has theoretical control because you're working in this fundamental setting and you can see what approximations you're making when they're breaking down. You can explicitly check that. And this wrapping around the compact direction provides an extra scale and it modulates the power spectrum. So this is quite a nice way of looking at it. We know that in standard inflationary models, the inflaton field provides a clock or a time scale in the universe. This extra wrapping around the compact direction gives you another scale. So it's like having a clock with both an hour hand and a minute hand. So there are two scales in the system. So the potential looks like this. So it's basically a linear potential, and it is modulated by this cosine modulation. And the amplitude of the perturbations is set by mu. Of course, like in all inflationary models, mu is not predicted by theory, but it comes from a fit to the data. And this F is an axion decay constant, and it's sub-Planckian. And in the setting of this theory, you can tell that you can only have theoretical control over the model if F is greater than about few times 10 to the minus 4, and there's an upper limit as well. I'll show that when I come to the priors. And in terms of the modulations, this parameter B, we set it between 0 and 1 to prevent numerical instabilities or trapping in the other side of the potential. So we did a data analysis of this model, and this is, I have to say, this is pre-Planck analysis, so in this post-Planck age, it might sound a bit quaint, but it's still got very interesting results, which I will show. So when we do this data analysis, we use mode code. So all this does is rather than making slower approximations, for example, in this model, you can't do that because of these modulations. It directly solves the perturbation equations and calculates the modes numerically, which means it's exactly machine precision. There is also a good approximate solution which was used in the past by Flauger to analyze previous versions of the WMAP data. So when you do this direct mode integration, it dramatically slows down CAM, which is the package that we use to calculate the CMD spectrum, because of the oscillatory spectrum, the sinusoidal modulations. CAM actually uses interpolations between CL, so it doesn't calculate every L mode. It interpolates between them, and usually this is fine because the primordial spectrum is quite smooth. But in this case, you can have very high frequency oscillations in the L modes, so this interpolation is a bit dangerous. You have to also boost the K sampling as well as the L interpolation. So we have boosted the accuracy settings of CAM quite a bit And we've checked the numerical convergence to use a good balance between accuracy of the predicted primordial power spectrum and the speed that CAM takes to calculate a single CMB spectrum. So the sampling in terms of parameter estimation here is done using multinest. So you're probably familiar with Markov chain Monte Carlo, but it's not really appropriate when you have a very multimodal distribution. So because we have this oscillatory spectrum, the parameter space is the likelihood function is like a hedgehog. It has lots and lots of local maxima. And Markov chain Monte Carlo just basically gives up and dies in those kind of situations. So what multinest does, it implements a nested sampling algorithm. And what it does is to sample from the prior. And so therefore, each sample that it draws, each Monte Carlo sample that it draws, is not correlated with the others. And so this can be massively parallel. You can, for this project, what we did is that we put it on a supercomputer with thousands of cores, so we could get results in a very short time by having access to this full supercomputer. Bayes' theorem has come up in the previous talk, so let me just remind you what we're doing when we do parameter estimation and model selection from cosmological data. So this is Bayes' theorem. I'm sorry for the experts in the audience to take up time with this, but it's really important because this is where all of the information comes from that we present in cosmological talks. So this is the likelihood. When you have a data set, you produce a likelihood. This is very standard. And then this is the prior probability on your model parameters. And usually what you show are confidence intervals which are drawn from the posterior distribution, which is the probability of the model given the data. What's shown less often is this normalizing factor at the bottom, which is called the Bayesian evidence. So Martin showed this in his talk in terms of odds ratios. So if you have an evidence for a model, what it means is an integral of the model over a prior times the likelihood. It's a model average likelihood. You're probably familiar with using maximum likelihood as an approximate proxy for model selection, but that's not a self-consistent way of choosing between models. In fact, you have to calculate this. It's kind of like an overlap integral. And what this implements, it's often said, kind of incorrectly, that implements Occam's razor, but it doesn't mean that it penalizes models with extra parameters. It penalizes models which are not predictive, which is not the same thing. So for example, if two models with different numbers of parameters made exactly the same prediction, they will have exactly the same evidence. So if I, for example, take the Lambda CDM model and I say my height should be a parameter that has something to do with cosmology, of course it's not. So when I calculate the CMB power spectrum for Lambda CDM or Lambda CDM plus my height, they give exactly the same predictions for the CLs. So those two models will have exactly the same evidence, okay? So when you add extra parameters and they do not improve or keep the likelihood constant, that's when they get penalized. So hopefully that's an introduction to what I'm going to show in terms of model selection. So priors are very important. And part of the nice things about working with a model which is motivated from a fundamental setting is that we can come up with priors for these parameters that are motivated by physics rather than guesses. Okay, so the mass scale is given here. This is just an overall normalization. It's not predictive for that, but the axion coupling has been motivated to be in this range due to that having theoretical control in the model in that range. The oscillation amplitude, as I already mentioned, we set it between 0 and 1. That is the full range that you can do without trapping. And the phase is just a geometric parameter, so it has to be between minus pi and pi. And so these parameters are due to the cosmology, and they don't actually matter for this problem, so we have fixed them, and then we compare this versus the model, which does not have the modulations. So when we do this exercise, we get the following results from WMAP 9. So here is the axion decay constant parameter, and this is this B parameter. And we find two modes in the posterior, and they're shown here. And they're very, very sharp peaks, and this actually, yes. So these are huge. That's why you just see two of them. These are very thin and extremely high. So that is improving the delta chi-square by 19, and this is improving the delta chi-square by 12. So there are other peaks, but in this color scale, you just won't see them. So when you convert this to a 1D parameter, a posterior plot here, we have, this is F, and so you can see that they're like two delta functions. All of the probability are in here. And when you look at the marginalized posterior on B, so if there's no modulation, it should be peaked on zero, and clearly there is still probability in here. Those two delta functions by themselves shift some of the probability into this kind of peak here. Okay, so what's the effect on the power spectrum? So that's the smooth model. That's a reference spectrum for B equals zero. So that's the best fit non-modulated model to the data. And this is the delta with respect to the power spectrum for that. And this is the higher peak, this is the lower peak. Okay. So there are oscillations in this best fit model which have, oscillations on the scale of about delta L of 20 to 30. As you can see, it's a logarithmic modulation, so it's not the same frequency all the way through. So those are the two best fit models. So remember, axial monodromy just predicts one modulation scale, right? It doesn't have two. So one of these two, or probably both of these two, are coming from fits to the noise. Both of these cannot be true. So then delta chi square of such values, 19 and 12, you know, that can seem very high. Often in cosmology, sometimes we get excited about delta chi square of 6 or something, so this is very high. But what does the evidence say? Because we should really see how predictive this model is. And the Bayesian evidence actually gives you roughly even odds versus lambda CDM. So it has three extra parameters. It has roughly even odds with lambda CDM, like 1 to 1. So the maximum likelihood, as I mentioned, does seem very high. So this is a cautionary tale of not to use maximum likelihood to decide whether you've got a dramatic breakdown of the standard model. So at least in WMAP 9, the linear axial monodromy model with no modulations was right on top of the lambda CDM maximum likelihood values for example, NS and R. So this improvement comes relative to both B equals zero and lambda CDM. So it's a significant improvement, but with this data set, it's not compelling. By the way, if I fixed mu, the overall amplitude, and didn't allow it to vary, I would get an improvement of about 11. So having this parameter overall amplitude varying significantly changes the best fit delta chi square. So is this coming from some, I don't know, couple of points somewhere in the L range? Is it coming from just a few spurious points? So to check that, what we did was we calculated the delta chi square effective as a function of L contributed from so this is actually the best fit, the very, very high delta function peak, the lower F peak. And so when you smooth that delta chi square distribution with a window of delta L of 10, you get something that looks very wrappy, so you keep smoothing. And when you smooth it at delta L of 100, the structure emerges. This is just the first two peaks. Yeah? So it's coming, this improvement is coming from the full L range where W map has signal to noise. So I said that this has some link to bispectrum constraints. So once you make a fit to the power spectrum, you can predict the bispectrum for this model. And it actually predicts resonant non-Gaussianity, which Kendrick covered on the first day. This is studied first in these papers by Chen, Easter, and Lim. And in the case of monodromy, it predicts resonant non-Gaussianity, which is studied in this paper. So resonant non-Gaussianity has little overlap with the standard shapes, and it's not currently constrained. So when we calculate the prediction for resonant non-Gaussianity from the two peaks that we see, so those are the two peaks, and one of them predicts FNL resonant of 400, and the other one of about 2500. So it makes a prediction which is very firm that you can go and test those two peaks. So this is why I was very excited on Monday when I was told that there is a way to construct an estimator for this very strange kind of non-Gaussianity. So just to summarize this part of the talk, you see this large high-frequency modulation in WMAP9. A similar analysis, not exactly the same, was done for Planck to look for oscillatory modulations to the data, but not at this frequency. And also, WMAP and Planck appear different in several aspects, so I haven't gone and done the Planck analysis yet. It's good if this was something to do with the primordial universe that we are seeing in WMAP, of course, it's very significant. And so it's better probably not to rush into an analysis of Planck till it has stabilized. The delta chi-square is larger than most anomalies, but it's not compelling yet in the terms of model selection. Even if it's real, it could be a systematic. I have a couple of ideas for systematics which could generate an effect like this. But it's an interesting model, and it's eminently testable through predictions for the scalar, power spectrum, the bispectrum, and of course it's a large field model, so it makes a prediction for detectable denser spectra. So that's the end of the first part of my talk. And now I want to move on to issues in non-Gaussianity from large-scale structure, and I want to present a case study of a slow digital sky survey quasars, which was done in collaboration with these authors. This is my very excellent PhD student, Boris Leisted, who's done quite nice work on this paper. Primordial non-Gaussianity from large-scale structure surveys. This is primarily currently being studied through scale-dependent halo bias, which was put forward in this nice paper by Neil Dalal, who might be in the audience. This is the constraint from various kinds of large-scale structure traces that was first done when this paper came out using that method. It's a paper by Slozai et al. And you look at this error bar, so this is FNL. I'm sorry for the back of the audience if you can't see. This is 100, that's minus 100. So this is a whole bunch of different traces. And you can see most of them are very unconstraining. The best constraints come from quasars, okay? So this is an updated version just from a couple of months ago by Tommaso Gianantonio. And again, the best constraints come from the quasar autocorrelation. And that is not surprising to understand. So quasars are bright, highly biased tracers that span very large cosmological volumes. So you see here SPSS3. And so galaxies are in here, spanning cosmological volumes of that size. And these are quasars. So they probe very large volumes. And so therefore, they probe super horizon fluctuations. and large-scale modes, and therefore have sensitivity to fundamental physics through the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect and primordial non-Gaussianity. And many, many papers have studied these kinds of effects and made constraints from the sample I'm going to present now. So some of those papers here. So the catalog we're going to use is this Richards et al. 2008 catalog, which is the largest catalog of quasars detected in photometric surveys. That's about 1 million objects. So if you're not familiar with what this is the SDSS footprint, the shape of the SDSS survey on the sky in an ecliptic projection. So usually you see CMB maps and galactic projections. So this is an ecliptic projection, and the galactic plane goes around like this. So this is the northern sky. And so when you just take the power spectrum of this survey, so this is L versus L times CL, this is the observable that you would use to try to detect this scale-dependent halo bias effect from non-Gaussianity. And what you can see at large scales when you take the power spectrum is that there's excess power. So you could jump up and down and say that that is primordial non-Gaussianity, but it is not, because there are many systematics, which I will show, will contribute to producing an excess power in that region. So in fact, even though I showed you those constraints from various papers where these quasars were giving the tightest constraints on the halo bias, recently in papers by Pullen and Hirata, Gianantonio, etc., they have made concerns about the use of this sample for clustering studies, because they said that these systematics just could not be mitigated, and this was not therefore a trustworthy sample to use. And in this work, what we did was to use this sample as a test bed, essentially for future surveys, to work out ways to mitigate systematics at very large scales. And we have eliminated this excess using appropriate techniques that I will describe. So I will start by summarizing the sample. So photometric quasars, why do we need photometric quasars? What are they? Okay. So to confirm an object to be a quasar, you have to take a spectrum. But spectra are time-consuming to take, and they're very expensive, both in terms of telescope time and in terms of money. So spectroscopic catalogs are small, and they're incomplete. Here's a spectroscopic catalog. This is one of the most extensive catalogs available now. That's from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey DR7, Data Release 7. And there are about 3 quasars per square degree. It's very inhomogeneous, as you can see. This is the Richards et al. Photometric quasar sample of 1 million objects. And that's a sample where there's about 15 quasars per square degree. So this is the DR6, which is the latest available version of this catalog. They're just about to put out a new version. And so this is just from photometry, right? So you take observations in a bunch of optical bands, and you can use a classification algorithm. In this case, there's a Bayesian classifier based on kernel density estimation in order to classify these objects from other point sources. So quasars appear like stars, quasi-stellar objects. So you have to separate them essentially from stars. And the classifier assigns you a probability to be a quasar or a star. And you can make various quality cuts on that classification in order to say, oh, here's a basically pure sample of quasars on the sky. And then you can study the clustering properties of this thing. And the clustering properties are studied through the angular power spectrum. So estimating the angular power spectrum just from this raw sample, let's divide the sample into 4 photometric redshift bins. So here we have between 0.5 and 1.3, 1.3 and 1.8, 1.8 and 2.2, and then a combination of these two. And yes. They used a much earlier version of this. They used DR3, and they did not have the Richards et al. Classification. They had a partially classified catalog, and on top of that, they used a nearest neighbor kind of thing. So that analysis used a very kind of premature version of this work.
So how much bigger is this sample?
This is, I don't remember the earlier sample. I've never used it. In fact, I probably wouldn't use it. This one is like a million objects. So if you just take the raw and get a power spectrum, you see an excess here in all of these redshift bins. So why is estimating the angular power spectrum an issue? Okay, power spectra must be estimated from cut sky data. When we calculate the theoretical prediction, we calculate the theoretical prediction for the full sky, and we must estimate the full sky power spectrum from cut sky data. And this is especially critical on large scales due to cut-induced variance. So a typical CNB mask has a pretty small cut, as you can see there. This is a large-scale structure mask. That's a very small part of the sky. F sky is roughly less than 0.2. So you had to somehow mitigate this. Here are two typical estimators that are used for power spectrum estimation from cut sky data. The quadratic maximum likelihood estimator is it's optimal. That means it achieves minimum variance. And it requires a model of the pixel-pixel covariance matrix. So that's the pixel-pixel covariance matrix. So this is the angular separation between pixel I and pixel j. And you can see this is a theory spectrum here, Legendre polynomials, and here you can put the noise and the systematics. The other estimator that's used is the pseudo-spectrum estimator. So it is like a quadratic maximum likelihood estimator with a diagonal pixel-pixel covariance matrix or a flat power spectrum. Okay, so that essentially means you're assuming that this pixel is either equally correlated to all the other pixels or else uncorrelated with any of them, okay? So which should be used for large-scale structure? So this is a case where it's actually different from the case of the CNB. So the CNB is very red. At large scales, it drops like a rock, and then it flattens out. So that means that that pixel is correlated with other pixels on the sky by the C of theta, the angular correlation function, which is non-zero over quite a large pixel range. In case of large-scale structure, this is a typical large-scale structure power spectrum for quasars. It doesn't drop so dramatically at large scales. It's actually quite close to being flat. So therefore, unlike in the case of the CNB, pseudo-CL is nearly optimal, but only in the absence of systematics, as I will show. So let's get to systematics and masks. So here are some systematics. So what is the issue here? So the spatial variations in calibration and observing conditions lead to a spatial modulation of the quasar counts. Here is a bunch of typical systematic effects that you would have in a large-scale structure survey. So remember, this is in ecliptic coordinates, and so the galactic plane is going around like that. So out here, there are quite a lot of stars. Okay. These are effects due to the transmission of the light through the atmosphere. This is dust in our own galaxy. This is variations in seeing because of the variations in the atmosphere from night to night through observations. And you can see that there are large correlations induced in the observational conditions and the data, therefore, through these various effects. And some of them are correlated, of course, with each other. So we wanted to make this sample useful for cosmology. And there are many techniques available to the observer in order to do this. First thing is just the dramatic thing of just cutting the sky, throwing away part of the data, saying, I don't trust that data. So here is a reference mask. So what I'm showing here is the mask that was used by all the studies which concluded that this sample was not useful for cosmology because it was too contaminated. So we started with that mask, and so we can this table is not too important, but what I want to say is that you have a bunch of systematics and you create a mask by cutting or thresholding on those systematics. And these are the thresholds that are used to make mask one. But you can make more stringent masks by making more quality cuts on these systematics. So there are two different versions of these masks that we created. We call them mask 2 and mask 3, just for originality. And so then we have this thing called mode projection. So I told you that, you know, if you had perfect data with no systematics, PCL, pseudo-CL, which is actually much easier in terms of numerics than the quadratic maximum likelihood estimator, is actually couldn't be optimal on large-scale structured data because it has roughly flat power spectra. However, it is suboptimal when you have complex masks like the one that I showed here. So it would be pretty, it would work pretty well up here, but with this kind of very complex mask with lots of holes, it will not. And it cannot handle systematics. So we use the QML estimator, even though it's numerically much more expensive, with mode projection. So what is mode projection? So imagine that you've got a bunch of systematics. What do you notice here? This is the actual RQCAT catalog, and it kind of looks like, you know, it has no structure. It's quite homogeneous looking. Whereas these stars, or say the dust, have spatial structure, right? They are not isotropic fields. So in fact, if you look at these things in terms of ALMs, they populate certain ALMs and they do not contaminate others. So what we can do is this thing called mode projection, where you can marginalize over a linear contamination model for the systematics map using these systematic templates. For example, so this is the same equation I showed you before. This is the pixel space covariance matrix. So that's the theory. This is the noise, which in this case is just short noise, okay? And here is the marginalization of the systematics. So you've got this. So C here is an ordered list of the pixels. So it's essentially a map. And so K is given, so K is an index over the different systematics. And out here, you've got this coefficient. And by sending that to infinity, you're essentially assigning infinite variance to a pixel mode of the systematic, so a particular LM mode. And you can essentially project out those contaminated modes out of your data. So now we look at redshift distributions and theory predictions. So am I getting to the end now? Okay. So I'll just show you a couple of things then. One thing that is, so I talked a lot about the data analysis. We also have issues in large-scale structure of how to make theory predictions to fit to your data. So I told you that when you have spectra of quasars, you can confirm that they're indeed quasars. The second thing you can do is to get a redshift for the quasars. Okay, so here's spectroscopic versus photometric redshifts. Okay, so redshift estimation through photometry is done by a variety of methods. Most of them work pretty well, so you can see that there's quite a lot of objects along the diagonal, but there are also catastrophic failures. And so redshift distributions for most of these photometric samples are very poorly known, and it impacts the robustness of the theory power spectra. So estimating redshift distributions can be done by cross-matching this catalog with another catalog, which is a spectroscopic catalog, and accounting for the different selection functions. So this requires you to apply completeness corrections, and most studies do this just for the magnitude. But in this case, we found we had to do it also as a function of position on the sky, because the spectroscopic catalog is quite inhomogeneous. And previous studies used tiny catalogs of very different selection functions in order to do these corrections. And we found that if we actually used SDS-SDR7 cross-match with ArcheoGAT, it has roughly 100,000 objects in it, and the completeness correction is much more robust. So these are our completeness corrections as a function of redshift bin. And another thing that one has to do is when you do this line of sight integral, this is a cartoon of the relevant equation. You do not just need the redshift distribution, but you need this magnification effect due to lensing of quasars from a foreground structure. And we can estimate that from data as well. And that's quite a big effect. So here's a combination of all of these effects. So we calculate the theory power spectrum using this CAM sources program, using the completeness correction applied NMZ distributions. So the solid line is the best prediction. The dot dash is if you neglect the completeness correction. If you get it wrong, of course, that will also be wrong. And the dash is if you neglect magnification. And we found that several studies in this of this catalog to obtain FNL have actually completely ignored the magnification as far as we can tell. And so just to get to the end of the talk, we have the ingredients, which is the QML estimator. We have an improved mask. We have mode projection. And we have robust theory predictions. And we can use auto and cross spectra of ArcheoCAT, both with individual redshift bins and also cross spectra with the systematic to see if we have eliminated correlations with the systematic templates. And we found that using all of these tools together, we have eliminated all these spurious correlations. And so so the low redshift sample, we were not able to do so. Okay, so here is before applying any of these tools, and this is with our best version of the data analysis. So this indicates that there's some remaining systematics in this data. We have some indication that it could be white dwarfs, which we have not accounted as one of the systematics. So that's not so good for the low redshift sample, but the high redshift sample, we actually managed to clean it in alpha cosmology. So here is the reference mask with the old style analysis, and you see this excess of power that can be misinterpreted as primordial non-Gaussianity, and this is the best analysis that we did with the best mask, the mode projection, QML, etc., and basically the chi-square per degree of freedom for the lambda cedium spectrum is pretty good. The cross correlations with systematics have been eliminated. So let me conclude. So photometric quasars have high cosmological potential, but they're plagued by systematics. In this work, we mitigated the systematics using masking, quadratic maximum likelihood estimation, mode projection, and robust redshift distribution estimations. And in the future, we plan to apply these kind of techniques, the dark energy survey where the data is now coming in, and also to SDSS3, where an update of the photometric quasar catalog that we used will actually be released in a couple of months. Thank you very much.
Questions, anyone?
So how does the QML compare with SPICE? Have you?
With SPICE?
Yeah.
SPICE is just PCL. If you Legendre transform the CF theta, you get PCL. So it compares with SPICE in the same way that QML compares with PCL, like I showed.
Okay, I have perhaps a sort of naive question. So for the CMB, for the large scale modes, the solution is to sort of use a pixel-based likelihood where one basically tries to have an exact likelihood with quite a bit of coarse graining and the computer does all the work. Is that possible here? Or are the effects just too difficult to characterize? Maybe you could just say a few words about that.
Yeah, this is a very good question, actually. So for kind of current data and probably data coming in the next 3 to 4 years or so, these kinds of methods we think are adequate just to use QML and characterize the full covariance matrix in a harmonic space. But for distant data like, you know, Euclid or LSST, I think that we should probably develop methods similar to Commander, where we do full estimation of the systematics at the same time as the you know, the cosmological signal. And I think that's fully feasible. You need to have, of course, a characterization of all the systematics. But for large-scale structure, there's so much information about those things that we can probably get it.
So it is possible, in your opinion.
It is possible and will be necessary, and you know, will have to be developed.
So so you showed the CL quasar power spectrum, and you showed it at low L because you were interested in whether or not there was this extra power in this primordial non-Gaussianity. But what would those data points look like if you showed it going out to high L, if you were interested in any damping or cutoffs or anything like that?
Interested in what?
In any damping or cutoffs at high L. If you showed that going all the way out, what's the highest L that you would go to?
Okay, so if you, I would go to about L of 500 perhaps. But what happens with this particular sample is that it's 15 quasars per square degree, right? So shot noise will eventually take over. So you will have the primordial, the cosmological signal, and then eventually it'll flatten out because short noise just looks like a flat power spectrum at high L. So there's no need for this sample to go to very, very high L. But these kind of techniques also get applied later to estimation of, say, shear power spectra from large-scale structure surveys, where for dark energy survey, they're planning to go to, I don't know, L of 2,000 or even higher. And so for those estimations, we think PCL will be completely fine. It's a low-memory, very fast algorithm. And so what we will have is a hybrid estimator where at large L, less than 500, say, you would have QML. And then at high L, you would probably have a PCL estimator and joined in the middle.
So I guess I want to complain a little bit about this strategy that you're trying to clean this as much as you can. And if there's something left, you don't trust it. Because that means you're never going to ever find a signal that you trust because
I think a mischaracterization of what I said. So it's not that if there's something at large scales we don't trust it. It's more that we know that there's residual contamination because we can cross-correlate this map with each of the systematics. Mm-hmm. And the chi-square per degree of freedom for those cross-correlations tell you that it's not, there's some correlation. So for example, I'll show you this gory table where you have chi-squares per degree of freedom and the probability to exceed that's associated with that. And Gaussianity is actually a very good assumption here, so chi-square is a good thing to do. And at the bottom, you can see the cross-correlation for each mask with each of the redshift bins and the different systematics. And statistics like that can tell you that there's residual contamination. So it can tell you how much you need more to clean or whether you trust it or not.
But I think that's what you did. You did do the basic optimal cleaning that you can do.
That's right.
But still, you got some residual and say you don't trust
at low L.
At low
sorry, at low Z.
Yeah. So why don't you trust it?
Because we see residual contamination at low redshift, and it is, we know exactly what it is as well. There's one thing that we don't know, which is that in low Z, we know that stars' air mass seeing, and something that we don't know, that what the systematic is still in there.
How do you know that unknown, there is an extra unknown thing?
How do we know there's an extra unknown? It's because the chi-square per degree of freedom is very bad for that redshift wind.
Okay. But I mean, that could be just non-Gaussianity, right?
It could be non-Gaussianity, but we know that, so we considered like five systematics, mm-hmm. and we know there's one more, and it's particularly correlated with low redshift, and that's white dwarfs. Okay. So we would have to use a catalog of white dwarfs and add it to this thing and see if we clean it. So I completely agree with you that you cannot use the best fit model as your arbiter of whether you've got a good enough fit or not. Mm-hmm. The purpose of this study isn't to do that kind of estimation. It's just to see, can we use the catalog at all? And if you were doing a proper cosmological study with this, then you would have to do more work. Rather than just comparing with the best fit model to determine when you've succeeded.
Thanks.
So is the QML code publicly available, or?
I can't hear you.
Is the QML code that you use, is it publicly available, or are you?
Very good question. We are planning to release it publicly. The student who wrote the code is a brilliant coder, so it'll be completely understandable, and it'll be a very fast, low-memory algorithm. So we do plan to release it, including all the bells and whistles.
Looking forward to that.
Great. Well, now's probably a good time to break for lunch. So thanks very much, Irani.